This is WGXC 90.7 Accra, the Wave Farm, radio for open ears. My name is Sal Cataldi, and this is the latest installment of Reading is Funkdimental. This is a monthly show where I talk to people who write books about music, often including musicians themselves. Those first two tracks you heard, the first one was something called Tropical Depression from an album that I am involved with, just came out. It is from a band called the Harry Carey Oki Trio of Doom. It features people like Percy Jones from the Eno Band and such. And the one right after that was Summertime by Albert Eiler. I actually am a local musician. I play with a band called Spaghetti Eastern Music and several other projects. And I write about music for, I've written for the New York Times and Rolling Stone, Inside Out, Upstate New York, Pop Matters, and New York State Music, where I reviewed the book we're going to talk about. It is called Holy Ghost, The Life and Death of Free Jazz Pioneer Albert Eiler. It was written by Richard Colodda, a very interesting attorney slash jazz musicologist. It took him decades to write this book. It covers Albert's early time in Cleveland, his developmental time in France when he was playing in the Army Band, his great days, his in recording in Copenhagen and the Netherlands, all the controversy about free jazz in New York that he spurred, and his mysterious death in 1970, drowned in the East River, murdered, we don't know. Was he tied to a jukebox? Possibly. Richard is going to actually clarify all of that stuff in this interview, so stick around, and here we go. Okay, here we are with Richard Colodda, who wrote a fantastic book called Holy Ghost, The Life and Death of a Free Jazz Pioneer. It's about all about Albert Eiler. First, I want to just hear a little bit about you, because you have a very interesting life. You are an attorney by day and a musicologist with a huge passion for music and jazz and I guess free jazz. It sounds like you did drive your mother a little bit crazy with playing the free jazz.
The 60s, yeah. I was with Capitol Record Club. And they had these guys out in Village Vanguard. Coltrane was standing outside. I said, I just liked the picture of this in their little flyer. And I bought it. And my mom couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of other ones she didn't like Dylan and The Doors. But what happened was... As for the degrees, it was just happenstance. I went to Cleveland State, and this was in the late 60s. You got scholarships for the ability to sign your name and mm-hmm. grant. Really, I'm serious. I went through college for $2,000.
Wow.
And then I got a job at the library. And that meant they paid my way through school. So they paid my way through music school, BA, got a BM in music, Bachelor of Musicology, and then I paid my way through music grad school. And along the way, let's put it this way, I was a union steward. I saw the way they threw some of these people under the bus. Mm-hmm. I mean, this one boss, I think one of some guys were accused of using the N-word. Well, they were even off that day, but the kid was bugged about it. And so I had to defend them. I saved their jobs. And someone said, you're really good. You should be a lawyer. And I took the L, and I had this bossy girlfriend who talked me into doing the LSAT. She's not in my life anymore. But she said, you did good enough to get into Harvard. I said, yeah. And so I went to law school on their dime. I made it through law school. All my buddies owed $100,000 in student loans.
Wow.
I'm owing another about $2,500 just for the books. And I don't really practice that much. I mean, I got the luxury of having a state pension. Mm-hmm. It's the only cases that interest me and sometimes I'll even tear up the bills. Like, you know, right now I'm doing a dog bite case for a friend and, you know, she's mauled by a pit bull. And it's weird. I think Tuesday was so lucky for me, or Wednesday, because my case got lost in appellate court. Then all of a sudden, the Supreme Court of Ohio changed the law. And so it means it backtracks all. I mean, not only that, but it's stuff like that. You know, but I mean, I'm basically happy. I had a law torts prof who once said all the lawyers you knew were writers who wouldn't get a book deal. And I proved him wrong. And the next book is a true crime story. I knew the one of the victims. I also knew the sister of the killer who went to the gurney ride.
Well, I have to say, the book, I was married to an attorney, so I could speak of, and I know a lot of attorneys. And I think that what I really like about the book is it's so informative, but it is, there's not a lot of extraneous language. I'm a writer, I came out of PR, I'm a musician too. So, I'm big on adjectives and talking about what's going to happen. And I think your book really gets to the point. So, in terms of the genesis of the book, the whole genesis of the book goes back to your time in college when you interviewed Don Eiler. So if you could tell us a little bit about the whole process of this book and Eiler's connection to it and his dad's connection to it too.
Yeah, well, what happened was I was at a library sale in Newburgh Heights. I'm an inordinate book collector, and I bought this book called by Leonard Feather, Encyclopedia of Jazz in the 1970s. And I had a show at the time on WCSB Cleveland. And what happened was it had Donnie's phone number in the book, or his address, or his phone number was in the phone book. I said, why don't I do an interview with him? He was floored. He was floored someone had even remembered him. And ironically, I had crossed paths with him twice before, but didn't know it. The one time was I saw Pharoah Sanders at Fat Glenn's, which was a Cleveland State bar, and Donnie was in the band. And I've got to find it because I'd smuggled in the recording, a cassette recorder, and I've got tape of them. And the other time was I was with my first wife. I was off at Shaker Square, and I bought some records at a place on Buckeye Music, and the guy waited on me, and it dawned on me later on after I met Donnie, this was the guy who waited on me. But it was funny because I had my own show. I had two shows on CSB. I was second banana to a shock jock and did this act called Crow Psychic. Although they told me certain things were not appropriate. And then I had my own show, which was I call it Count Lapone's Jazz from Outer Space Makeout Hour. And I pretty much stuck to the track, and I had people come on if I could find them. I mean, the interesting thing about the book, it got me some good friends like Mudawef Shaheed. He's an imam who used to be played with Eiler as the name of Clyde Shai. And so what happened was he would bring me people on to interview too, like Larry Hancock, who later on played with John Handy. So I met some great people thanks to him. And and it's interesting because it was sort of as you said, the book is cuts through the thing, but you never read the original Ur text, which I called it. Then my girlfriend read, she says, this is 600 pages. You made it sound like one of your doctoral dissertations. And I realized she was right. I have an agent named Lloyd Jassen, and he said, cut it down. You'll never get copyright clearances on these things that you're quoting liberally from. And okay. So I did, and I had an editor who, some things he caught on me and some things I had to fix from his fixes. And there were just common things that you'd think about that were from my era and probably years. Like, for example, how come Lloyd Price served only 2 years in the Army, but Eiler served three? Did Lloyd Price get off for good behavior? No, but from your the age, if you enlisted, it was 3 years. If you were drafted, it was two. Then another one was Eiler's girlfriend worked at Kresge's. What is Kresge's? Things that are. And then there's another one I had to explain. You call it that because that was its official name, which was the Negro League, Negro American League. Because what's his name? Beaver Harris played for the Indianapolis Clowns. I learned always to double check everything and never take someone's word for it. So it became a fascinating journey. And there was one thing where he fixed up, and it dawned on me, FM, he added FM to the radio station. I realized FM did not exist in 1946 because Eiler's maternal grandfather was a radio preacher. And so I double checked it. A thing, and though what happened is it turned out the original, that station never didn't come on the air till the 1950s. So it turned out, go back to the original newspaper. And it turned out it was a typo. They turned the station, they put an M where an N should have been. So I had to fix it, correct from the 1946 or 1950s paper to correct what was really there. And then I had a friend who, I had three or four proofreaders. One friend says, it's not Ohio State University, it's the Ohio State University. Because not many people realize Eiler's grandson played in a Rose Bowl for Ohio State. And there are a few things that I caught. There's a few things. It's interesting too
Well,
because.
you also went deep on your research, and I understand that you had to translate, do some translation from some source materials too.
I was went to college in the days when you needed two languages to graduate. And I did the German pretty well. If you know German, you can make it through Swedish and Dutch pretty close. And plus, they have Google. You just key in the words, they can do it. But I figured it out. And my girlfriend jokes about it because we were on a cruise about not 2021 in the Danube and the Rhine. And she says, "You fell asleep during a talk show, and then you're answering them in perfect German." And, but then on the other hand, my buddy Pierre, my friend rather, my friend Pierre Crippone, who's a journalist as well, translated all the French for me. He joked, he says, you speak French, but you sound like a dock worker in Marseille. You saw too many Jean Gabin movies." But no, Pierre did the translations from French. I did the German ones myself. And when the Peter Nicholas Wilson book came out in English, I was floored because I said, "Oh, cripe." And the one thing for what it's worth, I left out any analyses because I was not going to challenge Wilson on musical analysis. He did a great job. I'm grateful to him that he set the path. And I was floored about how accurate my translations were. They were pretty much on the mark. The only one I think I changed was it's when he encountered one of his friends, Milford Graves, and she wrote he smiled, and I thought he wrote he laughed. No, or maybe the other way around. I changed. I thought smile and laugh.
Let's begin. Let's start at the beginning with Albert and talk about his childhood, his influence of his dad, the rigorous practice regime he had, and maybe what he listened to and what were his early inspirations. So we'll take us back to the beginning with Albert as a musician.
Okay, he was born in 36. He lived on Kinsman Road. And by the way, I forgot to mention his great grandchildren are musicians through Curtis. One plays trumpet, one plays sax. So his father beat him because, it's this whole thing like the Brian Wilson syndrome, where the father puts their unrealized dreams on their child. And instead of that, the kid actually liked music. And there's the story that he told Val Wilmer about playing footstool. So he picked up, was playing it along to the old radio that was there, and the father took him to some concerts, and so he did get around. He wound up he was also, but he made up stuff along the way sometimes. Like he grew up in the ghetto. No, he went to a school that was predominant, about 60-40 white black, and he played on the golf team, and ironically, I knew the scores. I looked up his golf scores. Now, his father told me how he came in second to Bob Shave in the Cleveland tournament. Now, this is apples and oranges. He did better against Shave in Cleveland than Jack Nicklaus did against Shave in Columbus. That's how good he was. He was like, it's interesting because they talk about his super. I didn't put this in the book, but so it was on, I heard on the Eiler broadcast on WKCR last Saturday.
Yeah, just on the Saturday.
His lung capacity was super, as was Donnie's. I heard from the Imam Shaheed about how he had to literally stuff a sock or something in his horn because he would shake the windows of the neighbors' houses with his volume. Now, Billy, I grew up in the country, so that'd be hard to explain that. But in the city, yeah, it could happen. And he was a great player. I found this great picture of him. By the way, if you ever check, it's P. Patrick Reagan's website has some pictures I could not use simply because of space limitations. There's one I found of him playing in a pit orchestra at John Adams. I suspect it's him. I just couldn't ID it. The picture was so blurry. But I used to go through all the old newspapers of every Call & Post because this was before they had the days of bullion of a Google search through the archives. I had to look through microfilms. And I found this great picture of the, and you'll see it in the book, of these kids at a playground in 1949. And I ID'd Eiler because the reason is back then there used to be any kid who had a birthday party got his picture in the Call & Post. And so that was kind of cool. But he played and he was great. But the weird thing about
Go ahead.
it, not many people realized Donnie could outplay him on sax when they were younger. Donnie, I've heard it from people who knew them both, and they said Donnie could outdo him. But Donnie wanted to be a baseball player, and so Donnie was a bit of shall we say, he screwed around a lot in
Yeah.
as a teenager. He wasn't dedicated enough.
So he went on to, he got a lot of his seasoning at, you said the Cleveland Academy of Music, starting at the age of 10.
Somewhat. And the guy was a veteran of some big bands. I think it was Lionel Hampton. I forgot the name of the guy who ran it, but yeah. And so he got a lot of the seasoning there. And what happened was he wound up playing. He was actually in the Cleveland Heights band. I mean, not the Cleveland Heights. John Adams Orchestra as well. I think obviously you don't use a sax in the oboe, but in the orchestra. So I think he played. I read he played oboe. So he wound up going, and they would hang out at this bar, and at Gleason's they met Little Walter. Now, Little Walter did not play Gleason's. He just hung out there because it was sort of how you say, just a spot where you'd go. But Walter was playing at a bigger place down the road. So Eiler met him, and his buddy Lloyd Pearson met them, and they went on this tour. And these two kids straight out of a straight out of East, a nice neighborhood are going to visit the ghettos of Chicago, Detroit. And for what it's worth, Cleveland at that time was not that ghettoized. You had, I mean, I put that in a book because it was run, it was organized during the era of the progressives, like Tom Johnson, who felt that, everyone should be, have a step up. So what happened was they went on a trip to Little Walter. Later on, he joined Lloyd Price.
And
The band.
what was his style at this time? And do you think, like, Little Walter had a very unique sound, amplified mic, mic'd, harmonica. So do you think that had an influence? And what was it? I mean, he was just playing nothing free at that point, obviously.
Just R&B. It
Yeah.
wasn't until he joined the army that he got the idea of playing free, and it must have been exposure to being in France.
Yeah, well, let's speak about that. I think you said in the book, and correct me if I'm incorrect, but as his divorce guys, you said that he joined the army to avoid paying $6 or $8 a week in child support or something like that, or am I make
He had what was called a, it was quaintly referred to in the 1950s as a bastard reaction, and that's what is actually cited on the documents. And I went and found out about that. Obviously that would still be sealed. What happened is I asked Donnie about it, and Donnie said, "Oh, he had a child, Curtis Rountree," and somehow I traced down, or rather, his Curtis's Jeff Schwartz has this web page about Eiler. And Curtis's mother wrote to Jeff, and for Jeff forwarded it to me about how come you don't mention Curtis in this in the book? Well, no one knew about Curtis but me at that time.
Right.
And I found out, and I got her email, and I called her, and I was wearing my cheek. I come over, and she bakes cookies. And she's in the Casper Collin movie, by the way. And she bakes cookies for me and my daughter because my car was broken at the time, so I had to use my daughter to chauffeur me to this interview. And my daughter still remembers the lady who baked us cookies. And she was nice, and she, but I was floored. Eiler did not stand up to his mother. I mean, that floored me. I mean, he tells her to get out because she didn't approve of her having a child, another child, before being married.
Right.
And, Curtis, I've seen every so often. He comes to some of my book talks I do at the library. Unfortunately, like sometimes I've only sometimes I think the last library's talk I did only showed up six people, but some of them are just there to get out of the heat. But on the other hand, that was what he joined the army for. But a lot of people, he covered it up. He how many people want to admit having an illegitimate child
So
or
let's talk about his time in the army and how it shaped his music. So he was in the army band in Orleans, and then obviously the French national anthem is one of the pieces that filters into his style.
correct. He was, and he was exposed to other people because he'd go on these field trips or what you call leave trips. And he'd go to Germany, he bumped into Roscoe Mitchell, and go to Spain. And he saw, oh, what's his name? The very famous jazz pianist from Spain. And also, The clarinetist, Peter Robinson, was there too, if I remember that
And he
correctly.
saw Coltrane and Miles, you said, during this.
Paris, and I went through and I documented through when it probably happened. He was being exposed to more avant-garde stuff, and obviously Sweden was ahead of the curve when it came to avant-garde stuff. That he, I think I put in the book, he did take a side trip, I mean a leave trip to Stock to Sweden. And that's where he was exposed to just the mind, so we say the freedom of everything, just that he wasn't exposed to the racism up that you'd have expected in the States.
Right, and that's why all the jazz guys loved Europe, because the famous trip with Charlie Parker, and he got away from the racism of America.
Right. And he was, Lord, but it was also just the expanding of his mind. And I realized this guy was really, there's certain things you pick up from his talks, his interviews. He was also like with it. For example, in that interview with Daniel Cook, he knew who Charles Ives was,
Right.
and that floored me. That, because just that I didn't even know about that till I went to music school. But he was exposed to probably a lot of the avant-garde stuff, and just that he could play in the clubs. And these people in Europe were pushing the boundaries at that time, even in France. But he had certain problems. He, so to speak, is he didn't know really when to wait for a solo. He would just join in as he felt like it, and that was
So,
something.
So when did he first go to Scandinavia? Was that immediately after the Navy, or he went back to the States, and then that's where he hooked up with Don Cherry and Cecil Taylor and cut his first album.
Right. He went up to he went home, and he actually was in Fort Ord. And he met what's his name? He was a famous Red Fox, and he had another famous musician who was a minimalist that he met there, Harold Budd. And so he wound
Oh
up,
wow. I didn't ever
yeah.
know that. Yeah. I didn't remember that actually.
So he comes back to the States, and he talks to his mother about this, and he says, "I got to go where I want to be free." And there's this great picture. I didn't use it. It's in the Revenant book. We're off to Stockholm. And it's where they had a farewell party for him for when he took off to Sweden. And so he took off there, but his mother says, "Who's going to take care of me? Who's going to take care of me?" And she was, again, a very dominating person. And so what happened is he took off for Stockholm. I remember he landed there on Good Friday, or either he took off or landed there Good Friday, 1962. And so he's playing in all these clubs in Stockholm. He gets a gig. And back then, it's one of those things that my friend the Imam told me about, is if you were black, you could probably just have a ticket to play. They didn't even ask if you were any good. He says how he says he picked up a bass in a store, and all of a sudden people are asking him if they could he could be in their band. I mean, this happened a little later. And the thing is, there's sort of a thing that this was your ticket. If you were African American, they wanted you in this band no matter what. And some of the girls would wait at the you tell me some of these women, like the one that Donnie got pregnant. He said see, they would wait at the wait for guys to show up who were African American and just move in with them. But in a way, it was sort of a variant time. When I was in school, I heard from friends who played bars in Germany, and they said if you're an American that play rockabilly, you don't have to be any good, you just have to be an American.
Yeah,
So
I had a friend who used to go every probably for about 5 years every summer to Norway, and they were a rockabilly band, and they made out like bandits
that's right.
financially and romantically.
Right. So it's interesting about that. So he played Stockholm, and that there's an interesting story. It was always a riddle whether he joined the band at the Golden Circle where he joined Cecil Taylor, or he
Right.
joined Montmartre. And that cleared it up because he was sort of a guest star at the Golden Circle. But when he had to play the Montmartre, what happened is they were doing a radio broadcast in Denmark, and they said, "Well, you can't be in the broadcast unless he's a member of the band." So Cecil says, "Yeah, he's in the band." So that's when it became official. And again, it's fascinating. You know, he's always lucked out with people who saw him at the right time and the right date. Like he's in Stockholm, and it's like also that Europe always beckoned him. whenever he was up the creek financially, or without gigs, he'd get a call from Europe. For example, well, the Stockholm business was his own adventure, but he bumped into Bengt Nordström, who did that album, Something Different. That is something again. How many times is someone going to be when you're at a club jamming and someone's going to be walking in, and you see the same thing with Stolman at that Christmas Day thing.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. So from just jumping ahead, in 1964 he comes to New York City, and he hooks up, like you said, with Stolman, makes Spiritual Unity, New York Iron Ear, and he gets a lot of press, but he's having a hard time finding gigs. So let's talk about his first time in New York, because then he goes back to Scandinavia, and then he comes back to New York.
Yeah, right. So he made the well, okay, so he did the Swedish Danish album and Summertime. I always play that when I do the talk. It's such a classic.
Oh, yeah. Great.
So he comes back to America and he heads up to New York. He crashes with his maternal cousin. In some books it's written off as an aunt, but she was rather, again, this whole family on his mother's side were super intellectuals. Like maternal grandfather was a radio preacher, and there's a statue to him somewhere in Alabama. Now his maternal aunt, Beatrix, was she was a she had a doctorate, I think, and was teaching in Japan on the State Department's dime. So she was very smart. So he goes to New York. He meets a guy named Carl Cobbs. And so then he cuts these
My
albums. I mean,
favorite piece is Angels of All.
that's funny because Donnie said that too, because he said there's angels all over, but we don't see them.
Oh no, the duet piece, the live piece, it's just the two of them. It kind of has a Little Rascals vibe to me, very childish. But
Yeah. And so he goes there, and like I said, but he has that commitment with Debut Record, the ones that,
debut.
yeah. He still has to cut the two albums. He brings his buddies from Cleveland. And again, that was one thing that Peter Nicholas Wilson hinted at, namely that Witches and Devils wasn't his comp. It sounded more like the Trumpeters, Norman Howard, but he couldn't prove it. Then all of a sudden, when I talked to the former Clyde Shai, he says, yeah, that was Norman Howard's composition. And it was basically witches, were white women, and devils were white men. No, that was Howard's philosophy, not Eilert's. Eilert just simply liked the tune.
So he at this time he gets some good press and he gets some crazy press. I don't know if this is exactly the time when they said it sounds like a Salvation Army band on LSD and like screaming the F word in St. Patrick's. I don't know if these criticisms came at this time, but then he retreats back to Scandinavia, right?
Yeah. So he goes back to well, he cuts the Eilert, I mean, he cuts the Stolman records in the summer of 64. And then he goes back to Scandinavia, or rather Denmark, Café Montmartre. And he plays a few gigs in Holland as well, at the Netherlands. I can't don't say it.
Yeah.
And he goes to the Café Montmartre, and some of these gigs are broadcast, and they've appeared subsequently in the Revenant Box and in Eiler Records in Sweden. So he cuts the album with Cherry, but it was a disaster, so to speak, because Cherry was strung, I wrote in a book, Cherry was strung out in heroin most of this time. And Sonny Murray was getting him clean. And this was wild because, how you say, Cherry hated him for this. And they were almost in fist fights over this because he didn't like to get clean. He needed his fix. So the band ended pretty much in disarray. Eiler left back for the States, and then he's playing. I forgot what it was when he appeared with Coltrane at the Titans of Tenor, but I think that was the next year. But he plays one more gig with Taylor. No, wait, I take it back. He comes back to America, and
And that's when Don comes into the picture, right?
yeah, because he needed a new trumpeter. Everyone thinks how strange that was, getting a guy who doesn't play at all to join and getting how you say straightened up. But he did well, but he knew Don had a limited repertoire, so we say. He could play all these songs and he could literally blow the tops off of his trumpet, blow the valves off his trumpet, but he didn't expand his thing. But on the other hand, he wrote one of the, Gary Ginnons called it one of the greatest jazz songs ever of the 1960s, either 1960s or 66. He wrote Our Prayer, and I know Santana does that. So Donnie learned trumpet from Charles Tyler, had him booted up. And so what happened was he joined a band. They played a gig at a how you say a house party,
Yeah,
and it
rent
was,
party or something like that.
and the place burned down the next day, and so then they're off to New York, and
Another Brian Wilson association. You
oh.
know, when they cut fire in the album. Oh gosh. At any rate, but go ahead. I don't want to disturb you,
No,
interrupt you.
so what happened was they go to New York, and well, he gets married because he had fathered a child before in around 64. He filed Desiree, fathered Desiree, finally married his girlfriend, the child's mother, 65. So I put this in the book. She was not amused because him and Donnie, or rather probably more Donnie, they blew the money on weed, the wedding present money on weed that they were supposed to get their place up. I don't know how long she lasted in New York. She always carried a torch for him. I know. But
Yes. So this is when through Coltrane he gets signed to Impulse Records.
Short, no, before that, no, that comes way after, because recording albums, he finally got around to recording the Spirits Rejoice album, and I put that in a book out. Charles Tyler was in the band. They did have some minimal. Yeah, you're right. They did have the thing with the benefit for Leroy Jones's thing. So you're right. That was where he was. They played that gig in March, and they did. Someone was issued an Impulse, but he was still recording for Bernie, and he did Spirits Rejoice. As I wrote, that they were strung out on heroin. But back then people don't realize cocaine was a nothing drug in the 60s. It wasn't until they learned how to refine it that it became,
And then all the rock stars started doing it.
but in the 60s, it was sort of, like Jelly Roll Morton used to do that nothing, So what they did was they were strung out on heroin when they did Spirits Rejoice, and then they wound up on Impulse. Although they had that last album with Baraka, which was called Sonny's Time Now, which is he dra that was another time when Cherry came back into the fold, and they did they pretty much disowned it because of some of Baraka's anti-Semitic lines in there, and that. So then they're going to they do some local gigs. They come back to Cleveland every so often. The interesting thing was the LaCave gig, which I put in the book, because it's I suspect that the owner recorded the Friday night session, but he probably was only into folk music, because what happened is Tom Paxton was supposed to be the guy who played, and Paxton got sick, so he had to four wall the place, so he rented it out to Hyler, and somehow Samson is just playing a gig for his buddy, who's the Peter Bergman from Fireside Theater. He's playing a gig at some at Shaker Square, and then running to the club just to watch the rehearsal. And then Eiler used him, but it was obviously controversy, because I'm going to suspect that he Samson was in the Saturday and Sunday night gigs, which was recorded by John Goldman. And then what happened was Tyler walked out. Now, I've heard it from three different versions. Was he was PO'd over Samson, obviously, because they'd have a bigger split of the meager takes that they were taking in. He didn't want to play with a white man, which was told by the Imam Shahid. And he was also, another version was he was bugged about Eiler lifting one of his songs, which was Poppy, that Eiler apparently lifted it, as he did to the Marseillaise, and which is the Devils. So that was the split between Charles Tyler and Eiler. Now, the interesting thing was Samson gave the band respectability among the avant-garde, because this guy was a violinist, and I was wondering what it had to do with his father being a violinist, Eiler's father, but or not. But so what happened then was they go off to New York, and it's pretty bad there. Again, they're living in the my friend your mom said it was literally flea bag motel, hotel. The place was a flea bag, so to speak. And there were bed bugs. And again, your mom came from a family. His father was an attorney. He said, I didn't need this stuff, you know, and he stayed in Cleveland. So they go back there. It's also interesting for the other incident that happened during that time at Le Cav, because Eiler's fascination with flying saucers and UFOs. And I
Right.
never hooked on that stuff before. I mean, everyone who watched sci-fi TV back in the 60s liked it. But what happened in Manoway, Ohio, which is near where I live, these cops saw a UFO and they chased it down the Route 5 into Pennsylvania, which is, or is it Route 50? And that was what became and it made nationwide headlines. And Steven Spielberg read about it and used it in Close Encounters, but it happened in Ohio. Ironically, I go down that road every so often. And so that was the big thing. But a lot of things are that he was also getting involved with the religion. Like he wrote that article, which I suspect he really cribbed his father's, some of his father's sermons, because his father wrote something. And I could see, and he said it over the air about get right with God and all that stuff. And I realized the syntax was pretty much close to what, that article to Mr. Jones. So I think Eiler cribbed it basically.
So
Okay.
when does he hook up with Mary Parks and sort of make the move to what is called a hippy dippy rock and R&B albums, the Love Cry and Newgrass?
Sometime in 67, because Donnie was out. He was not at the that he didn't even tell him about the club of go-go gig. The last time they played together was the Buffalo concert in the winter of 67. And Donnie was getting increasingly, how you say, mentally unstable. And it had to do with partially with drugs, but I also wonder if it was something simply, you know, simply could have been something generic. You know, I mean, we don't do DNA, you can't do DNA tests that determine if manic, depressive, or mental diseases are, how you say, part of your DNA. So we don't know. And so Donnie was out of the band, but it was never a complete closure. Obviously, they were brothers. And if you look at the last page of the illustrations, there's a ad for the French concerts in 1970. It mentions six, Donald Eiler's six group sextet. Yeah, sextet. And Donnie was invited to France, but he got stuck taking care of his mother back then. So, and you know, it could have been a great comeback for him. And obviously, but Parks, she had these, and it's ironic because I do actually like music as the healing force of the universe. And that sounded like something Albert would have written. But some of the other ones, like Tree is Like a Man is Like a Tree. I mean, that thing is a joke. I mean, it's like I wrote in a book, he should have gotten Laura Nyro to do it. You know, I mean, because apparently she was considered at one time to be the vocal, would have been a vocalist for Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but the label.
I just heard that recently.
And so they had that. But the weird thing about this was just because he was, he botched it up because it was a venture into uncharted territory musically. Now, if he had stuck with it a little while later, a little longer, he could have done great. I mean, there's this album with CD where I think it's Red Hot and Jazz where they have like Pharoah Sanders joining a hip hop group. And I think I would have been great with that stuff because, and he just was ahead of his time. You have to look at the rock musicians who admired him, like Verlaine, Iggy Pop, a fur coat in the middle of summer, and then putting Vaseline on his face. And I wrote in a book that was, might not have been Vaseline, it might have been olive oil because he did that in high school. His mother and then said it was a thing of, how you say, God, you know, anointing people with oil.
Anointing, yeah.
And subsequently, you know, he was, and the fur coat, he was always overdressed. And considering he had Mary Parks, who also was overdressed with the fur coat in summer, who knows why. But it might have simply been he was a fashion horse and fashion statement, and the fur coat overrode the common sense. So, like, And I didn't put it in a book, but my theory was he was wandering around New York, and it was the irresistible impulse, namely the suicide, against the common sense that it was going to get better. And but I mean the common sense that he had a fear of water. It was told to me by Donnie. It was told to me by Carrie Roundtree about that he had a total fear of water. In this, so and again, I went through some. It's the law practice. I went through some, how you say, coroner type reports. And suicide by black men isn't that common. It's kind of rare. It's usually
Yeah, very.
Caucasian males over the age of 40 who are gay or gay close, like say Robert Schumann, Tchaikovsky, Hart Crane, and oh, I can't think, Spalding Gray. So they don't. It's kind of rare among black men. So there's the theory of the accident. Yeah, you know, but it was hard to fall off of, hard to fall over a thing, you know, like that. What would he be doing near a pier anyway, but if he was afraid of water? And the other thing was, if it was murder, well, it could have been, because I still remember that story Carrie told me about her son had a vision, two men and a woman pushing him into the water. And he was wearing a shiny suit, which was the leather suit, which he was pulled out of the water in. So that could have been that he was mugged and just, but he, again, he had the passport. I don't know if he had money on him or not,
So who came up with the who came up with the fabulous jukebox theory?
I don't remember, but it came up about 7 years later. And, you know, there's this whole jive about him being murdered by drug dealers. And, you know, I
Right.
put down the guy was, who wrote it, actually his cousin is a friend of mine, and but that was just sort of something that it was really it appeared I think in Rolling Stone around 7 years later. I think Ralph Gleason mentioned it in up there, or somehow it came up 7 years later, but it came up years later, and there was actually so you know I just think what happened is he was wandering around New York, his girlfriend to you know not Mary Parks, but he had an Italian girlfriend on the side, but and she all of a sudden turned him away, and he had no money. What was he going to do? And he got depressed and offed himself by jumping in the river. Because you know, you think about other ways he could have done it. Well, climb a tall building. Well, no, they probably the way he was disheveled, he probably couldn't got past the doorman.
Yeah.
Buy a gun. No, you need money. Buy drugs. Again, you need money. So what was left? You know, the impulse overcame the fear of water. But again, I think the other thing is about the Japanese story. I'm beginning to believe it was true because it was something that I heard on the KCR broadcast on the 13th that is from Steve Heidelweiss. And that the they were play that what's his name? John Hammond wanted Eiler to record for Columbia. And they make this album, what they wound up making with Burton Green, but they were going to make this avant-garde jazz album. But some promoter in Japan wanted to turn Albert Eiler into the next Miles Davis. And you think about this, Bitches Brew didn't come out, I think, till later on, till after Eiler died.
70.
Yeah, 70. So, wait, no, wait, I take back. Eiler would have heard possibly of Bitches Brew, but he had these videos, you know, he could have been the next Miles Davis if he had stuck to it, gone super electric and everything.
Well,
So
yeah, well, on that note, I want to actually thank you for being on the show on Reading is Functamental. And I have to say, this is a fantastic book. And it's
thanks.
from the people at Jawbone Press. And frankly, I review a lot of their stuff because they put out great stuff. And I'm also looking forward to your next work, which will be the crime book. So thank you for joining us.
Okay.
And we're going to go out listening to some Albert right now.
They're doing a new book, by the way, of Eric Dolphy.
Ah,
Yeah.
well, we'll have to have that one on. Thanks
Yeah.
so much for your time.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me. Ciao.
Ciao.